This is an ABC podcast.
You know that saying of Jesus, a prophet is without honor in his own land? That's often true at first, but eventually they gain a following. Today on The Spirit of Things, two young truth tellers tell me why it's important to stay on message despite the backlash they've sometimes had to endure. I'm Rachel Kahn with you on RN. Both my guests are serious talkers and also singers. From Alice Springs, Jacinta Nampajimpa Price is a fierce campaigner for the rights of Aboriginal women and children. But when she's not on the hustings, she sings.
Sorrow and the pain that you feel inside.
That's Cry by Jacinta Nampajimpa Price from her album Dry River. I'll be speaking to her a little later about the human rights issues she's fighting for as an Aboriginal Celtic woman. One of the things Jacinta's up against is an over-idealized, romanticized view of Aboriginal culture. It's something all sacred traditions suffer from, and it's no less true of Christianity.
Born here in 1862, worked on the land.
John Dixon started out as a singer, but he set his sights higher, and today he's a much-published author, a university lecturer in early Christianity, and he's an ordained Anglican minister. But that's not all. He's also the kind of Christian whose love of history made him acutely aware of the highs and lows of his own faith.
So don't talk to me about religion. Don't preach to me about love. I don't need your help. Don't need your God.
Welcome, John.
So nice to talk with you, Rachel.
Well, this is one of my last interviews, and I wanted to talk to you, John, because you're pretty unusual in Australia. Most Christian ministers train in the faith and then find a pulpit in a suburban church or some Christian facility serving the community. But you wanted a bigger pulpit, the public square. When did you realize that that was for you?
Well, almost straight after I gained an interest in Christianity, to be honest, as a 16-year-old, having never been inside a church, you know, it was all a surprise to me and my family that I would end up interested in this. I started a band. So if I'm honest, it was when I started a band because I had this thought, I thought I'd invented Christian music.
It certainly had an unusual name, ironic perhaps.
In the silence. And we were so far from silent. So really from the beginning, I just thought it was a crying shame that the public wasn't better informed by a kind of generous, thoughtful Christianity than it was. And so I've always been interested in that, whether it's music, which is now long gone, or academia, or writing books, or establishing the Centre for Public Christianity, or indeed a pulpit. Very happy, very comfortable behind a pulpit, but also very happy teaching, you know, historical Jesus at Sydney University.
Yes, so. Well, all of those things you do very well. But CPX, the Centre for Public Christianity, has really walked into the public square, has claimed some space there. Has it changed over the decade that you were the director? I think you founded it in 2007.
That's right. Well, I think we've eventually worked out what on earth we were doing. I mean, when we first established this, we had this crazy idea that you could just get together a bunch of scholar communicator friends and walk into an office, write an op-ed, and it'll get published. And actually, it worked. We went in day one and said, oh, well, let's write an op-ed. How hard can that be? And indeed, it was very hard, but we were published. And so I think those first few years, we were just finding what we wanted to do. And eventually, it became pretty clear that we just want to be available to answer whatever questions the public has. And so being involved in the media was important. Writing books was important. And also producing documentaries. And we've just had one come out on the history of the church, subtitled How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined.
I know, I'd like to get to that in a moment, but your website is pretty sophisticated. You also anticipate the questions that the public might ask. You have Life and Faith podcasts, and I noticed that some of your guests are have also been on the spirit of things, like Greg Sheridan.
Yes, yes, of course. I mean, it has been a wonderful journey, speaking to all sorts of interesting people about big questions. And I think from the beginning, the people involved in the Center for Public Christianity were sympathetic to people's doubts about the Christian faith. And that was probably the key. You can't do that work unless you really know that people who are skeptical aren't idiots. They have reasons, whether intellectual or personal, they have reasons for resisting this stuff and asking questions. And I think everyone at the center has felt a great sympathy. I don't mean in that a patronizing way, but felt the force of their questions.
Nonetheless, Christians who venture out into the public square are usually labeled very quickly either right-wing advocates for a monocultural imperialist Australia, or they're left-wing revolutionaries, bleeding hearts, for example. So why
so
is that?
True.
So has it changed much? Is CPX trying to change that sort of polarized?
It is. It is. I mean, without claiming too much about, you know, we are the balanced one, because everyone thinks they're the center, right? But we have certainly tried not to bend to culture and fit in with culture, but instead remain faithful to historic Christianity. On the other hand, we don't think any of this stuff should be imposed on the world politically, legislatively, culturally, in any way. It's really about being thankful to be at the table for the conversation. And we have always imagined that what we are is guests at someone else's dinner party. And it's a thrill that we're there. And if they let us speak, you know, watch out, we'll go for it. But we want an invitation back to the dinner party. It's not our home. It's not our table. And so we've always wanted to be thoroughly orthodox in belief, in conviction, but really generous in the stance that we adopt.
Is that how you approached the documentary For the Love of God? It isn't a hard sell evangelist kind of approach to
it's
the
a big
faith.
Fail if it was attempting that.
It's definitely more nuanced, and viewers learned the good with the bad. As an advocate of Christianity, then, what were you risking in this kind of approach?
The same thing that the center has risked from the very beginning, and that is annoying Christians. That is really letting the team down. So that is always the risk, that if you're really trying to engage the world that's quite skeptical, you have to concede a lot, not as a strategy, but as reality. And so in the documentary, we concede that the church is worse than you ever imagined. We really mean that. The problem with being a student of history is you know where the bodies are buried. And this documentary was an object in discovering the bodies and bringing them onto camera, to push this analogy too far. So we deal honestly with the Crusades and the Inquisitions and the witch trials and the exorbitant approach to money in different periods. But at the same time, we wanted to show people what obscure historians all know, but the general public doesn't. And that is, actually, Judeo-Christianity, probably more correctly, has given the West some of the things it loves most. Its emphasis on charity, its love of love, its ethic of humility, the public hospital. All of these things really arose from the Judeo-Christian vision of what a human being is. And we wanted to interview the best scholars in the world, whether or not they're Christians, and let them tell that story.
Were you able to convince the atheists that, in fact, secular society might have actually been a product of the Judeo-Christian tradition?
Some know, but we've been delighted with some of the reviews from atheists who have said, oh, this documentary's made me a little less anti-religious. We think that's a great win. But of course, it's actually, for any atheist willing to look into it, it's very easy to demonstrate that the Enlightenment didn't invent these values of equality and humility and love. You only have to demonstrate empirically all of the texts we have advocating love and humility that predate the Enlightenment by centuries and do so in a Judeo-Christian context. And so it's very easy to demonstrate, but people have to be open to that journey.
And part of that journey is coming to understand who Jesus was and is, obviously, for a living faith. Jesus is often cast in very particular roles. Modern scholarship sees him as a revolutionary. Certainly that's how I've encountered him so often in modern texts or biographies. What do you think?
Oh, it's a hard question, right? And I spend 26 hours of lectures at Sydney University on just this question. We can wind right back and say he is definitely a historical figure and had a Jewish vision of life, comes from Galilee and had a vision of the one God who loved the world and wanted to restore all things. Gathered a group of disciples together and thought that they were the beginning of a new humanity, as it were, who would take his vision of a kingdom of love to the world. And of course, the whole of earliest Christianity was shaped by the crucifixion. I think it's hard for moderns to get their head around what a catastrophe that was for Jesus to have wound up on a Roman cross. It was the ultimate defeat. The ultimate shame. There was no greater shame in antiquity, in Roman antiquity, than naked, bleeding, dying on a Roman cross. And so the early Christians had to connect a lot of what Jesus had said about love and humility and so on with this new reality that he ended up on a Roman cross. And that suddenly flipped the whole honor-shame paradigm that the Mediterranean operated under, where honor was the chief good of life, accruing honor to myself, to my tribe, to my nation, and shame was the thing to be most avoided. I mustn't bring shame on my life. Whereas Jesus willingly went to shame on a cross, so the Christian story said, and rose out the other end of it. And the early Christians then reasoned that true greatness was a willingness to be low for others, to be shamed for others, to give up power for others.
So does that mean that Jesus, in some sense, makes peace with the imperial powers? That he has another plan,
this,
as it were?
This is a really fascinating question in scholarship, of course. What did Jesus think of Rome? Was he anti-Caesar? Or was he neutral? Or was he positive? And some people point to that famous instance where he gets a coin, a denarius, with Tiberius's image on it. In fact, I'm wearing one right here, Rachel, that you can see.
Right, the real thing. Always remind you.
It's good for radio. And said, whose image is this? They say, Caesar's. He says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. To my mind, this is a clue to something you find throughout the New Testament, that the earliest Christians were quite relaxed about the fact of the emperor ruling the world. But they thought that God required your higher allegiance and calls you to an ethos that is unlike Rome. So although they weren't anti-imperial, and I don't think Jesus was anti-Rome, I think he was saying to his disciples, you have a higher commitment, be a faithful citizen in the empire, but live by a different ethic. And that ethic is one of humility and love. And I don't think it's simply that the Christians were low class. This was Nietzsche's claim, right, that of course, they were the slave class, so they invented a slave ethic. Actually, I think that's quite misguided, apart from the historical fact that many of the earliest Christians were actually what we would call middle class, not peasant class, even leaving aside that fact. I think what drives this relaxed feeling about empire is they actually believe political power isn't the end game, that's only a tiny portion of real power. They thought there was spiritual power, and so they could be relaxed about who sat on the throne in Rome, because they knew they were going to change the world by spiritual power, not with force, not with violence, not with political power. That's the small game. The real game is spiritual power. And you know what? In the end, they were right. They slowly, through their own suffering and persuasion, transformed the Roman world long before there were any Roman emperors confessing Christ long before there were Christian armies.
Dr. John Dixon is the founder of the Center for Public Christianity in Sydney, and you can hear more of that interview on Christmas Day breakfast between 8 and 9 in the morning.
I sat talking to the wind today.
That's the voice of Jacinta Nampajimpa Price from her album Dry River. She's an elected member of Alice Springs Town Council and a campaigner for the rights of Aboriginal women and children. Their lives are often hidden from view in town camps and subject to beliefs and rules that can lead to violence. But it's not easy to question the old ways, and Jacinta knows the backlash can be severe. Today on The Spirit of Things, you'll hear why Jacinta believes it's time for reforming Aboriginal culture.
And it's your sweet sounds that I need.
Jacinta Nampajimpa Price, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
Well, it's really good to be speaking to you because this is my second last program of The Spirit of Things. So it's our last chance.
I'm honored.
Well, you know, in 21 years of the program, the understanding of Aboriginal identity has become perhaps a bit more sophisticated. And I find it interesting that you call yourself Aboriginal Celtic. And that kind of is different from the tendency that I've experienced, which is to always affirm only the Aboriginal side. Why is it important to you to name both parts of your heritage?
It's really important to me because I can't be whole without acknowledging both those sides to me, I guess. And I love the fact, I embrace and love my, you know, heritage on both sides. And my parents always brought me up to consider myself a citizen of this world. Like, I belong to the world. I'm not sort of just constrained to a particular part of it, but I'm part of humanity. And that's why it's so important for me to acknowledge that, I think.
Well, that's certainly the 21st century outlook. We are becoming very much more global. Jacinta, your mother is a Walpiri woman. What sort of dreamings did you inherit from that side of your family?
So from my Walpiri side, my mother is, her personal dreaming is honey ant, Yungaranyis, because she was conceived in honey ant country. But we also have Jungunba possum, Jajri, the quoll. But from Walpiri side, for me, on my personal dreamings comes inherited through the Walpiri men who I call father and my brothers. So I have my personal dreamings in terms of Walpiri country are Rain Ngapa and fire, Warlu dreaming.
So yeah. Rain and fire.
Yes.
That's an interesting combination.
Very much an interesting combination. And I feel it. I definitely feel it at times. And, you know, whenever it rains, I actually, when I was an artist performing hip hop, one of the first sorts of songs I sang with a new group that I'd joined, written was about the rain in Alice Springs and how significant it is in the desert and for locals. And it felt like whenever we sort of sang it, we'd get a bunch of rain come through.
And you also have a bit of fire in you as well.
Most definitely. I think it's good that, you know, at times I have the fire when I need it and certainly the rain to put out that fire when I need it.
Right. Well, have they played a role in your early life or even in your later experience?
Well, certainly, I guess, when it's come to music for me and also knowing as well parts of that country that those dreamings are associated with and being taken out to that country as a teenager and being told those stories and why they're sort of significant to me and understanding that I have a responsibility to those dreamings as well has certainly played a role for me. And of course, my other personal dreaming from my place of conception comes from Tiwi country, comes from Crocodile Deep Salt Water, or in Tiwi, Chikabanga is the crocodile dreaming. And, you know, I feel like a great sense of like I'm tied to that part of the country as much as I'm sort of tied to the desert, although we left when I was a toddler from up there. But
that was Darwin?
Yeah, up on the Melville Island in the Tiwi Islands, Millikuppery. Oh,
well, your father, Dave Price, is from Newcastle with a Catholic background. And I think he told me at one point that he kind of dragged you along. I mean, I shouldn't say drag. He took you along to his sacred sites in Europe, so to speak. I mean, the cathedrals and so forth when you were young. How did you experience them? I mean, were you excited to see them or were they all very strange?
Look, I was absolutely excited to be there. Probably being a 12-year-old and having felt like I'd seen every standing stone and cathedral throughout Europe and Ireland, there were probably points where I felt I was being dragged, but for the most part, especially knowing that my ancestors came from Ireland also, there was certainly a deep spiritual connection there for me, and understanding in a way that when it came to Celtic ideology is very similar to my Warpri understanding of the beginning and the idea of Dreamtime stories, you know, visiting places like the Giant's Causeway and learning their dreaming story of how that came about with the giant on one side and his lover on the other, and trying to create a bridge by throwing stones into the water. And it's the same concept when it comes to Tjukurpa and dreaming and talking about the creation of the land and those stories. And there's often morals and ethics within those stories that you live by as a result. So, yeah, it was a really beautiful understanding, and also knowing, just like when you're in my country, that my mob were there for over 40,000 years, you feel almost this, the presence of their spirits. Well, if going into cathedrals that were hundreds and hundreds of years old, feeling the presence of the spirits that had moved there and been there also. And even in the landscape in Ireland, you know, it was that coming together and recognizing all those similarities, which is, you know, all to do with being human, I guess.
Yeah, well, but how about the Christian story, for example? I mean, that's very specific and, you know, it was after the Celtic dreaming, as it were.
Absolutely. Well, look, I think every you know, group of human beings has their story sort of very similar. You know, when it comes to Indigenous culture, you know, our young boys go through men's business and they're, I guess, in some ways like Jesus, sacrificed, but they're brought back resurrected as men, if you like, sacrificed as children and brought back resurrected as men. So there are often those sorts of similarities. And I know that, you know, my grandparents became Baptists through the Baptist Church at Yundamu, and many different groups of people belong to different groups depending on, you know, what mission was there set up in their community. And I guess the wonderful thing is, in terms of Christianity, a lot of Aboriginal people never replaced their beliefs and their Tjukurpa, that which really is part of them from the moment they're born, but add Christianity as another layer and make it work with Tjukurpa, or run alongside or entwine with Tjukurpa as well.
Well, that's real adaptability. But when you were growing up in Alice Springs, because your parents moved to Alice Springs, and I think most of your life you spent in Alice Springs, when you were young, how were you as an Aboriginal person meant to relate to the white fellas?
I guess for me, it wasn't necessarily a hard thing, because I was completely aware that half my family are all a bunch of white fellas, and I was also surrounded by other people in the community and close family friends who in the same situation had an Aboriginal parent and a white parent. And it was like the norm, I guess, growing up in Alice Springs in that respect. So, and I think my grandfather, my Warlpiri grandfather, well, particularly my whole Warlpiri family, never actually viewed people in terms of the colour of their skin or even their cultural, you know, background. They viewed everybody as human. And so that's the sort of lens I looked through and saw the world as just people who are humans. And the thing that separates us is simply, you know, in our minds is that culture that we've been brought up in. But otherwise, we're all the same.
So was that sort of open and sort of blended attitude easily accepted?
Absolutely. It was definitely accepted. I mean, I can't really even think of moments in my upbringing where I've ever been racially vilified by a white person. Either, you know, I wasn't looking for it or I just never really experienced that sort of thing. Our community was a community where we all got on with one another, and I think those differences have been more apparent as I've got older and looked at other parts of the country, actually.
Did Aboriginal kids ever question your friendship with white fellas?
Actually, you know what? That does pose, you know, an important aspect of, I guess, when I was in primary school, that was the case. But once you hit high school, there was this sort of separation that did go on. And I mixed in lots of different circles. You know, I had white fella friends and Aboriginal friends and, you know, family. And I often found myself, I guess, either being that link in between or bringing those sort of sides together at times. And sometimes, of course, there was definitely that separation. And it probably had more to do with, you know, socioeconomic differences as opposed to racial differences, if you like.
Jacinta, I spoke to your parents back in 2012 for a couples series, Bess and Dave Price. Both of them were teachers. How did they influence your outlook?
Yeah, they were both teachers. I remember in primary school, Mum did a little bit of work in the school that I was at, so I felt like I had that immediate support there, and you know, parents who were always very much involved in my education and supporting me through that. And I think the funny thing though is that when your parents are teachers, and when it comes to particular subjects, like Dad was English and history, and I think he probably expected more of me when it came down to history, but right. That's always sort of the case. However, you know, English was definitely one of my stronger subjects, but it was always encouraging to know that they were involved in education, and it was an important part of my life.
Jacinta Nambajimpa Price is the daughter of former CLP member of the Northern Territory Legislative Assembly, Bess Nungiyari Price and Dave Price. You're with the Spirit of Things on RN. Download us using the ABC Listen app. I want to ask you about the beliefs and traditions that are Aboriginal, that perhaps were there in the background or maybe even in the foreground. I know that Indigenous beliefs include beliefs in sorcery and evil spirits. Did they play a role in your life?
Certainly they played a role in my life. There were moments in my life where I remember, you know, having a sore tummy as a little girl and Mum taking me to see a healer and, you know, the healer sort of performing what they would do and rubbing my tummy, and they use their sweat and rub your tummy, and that's part of, you know, the healing process and that sort of thing. It certainly, you know, was part of my life. You know, growing up, when you sort of look back, I think when it comes to the idea of sorcery, you know, all premature death or illness is believed to have been caused through sorcery. And that was something that, you know, I believed as a child. And as I got older as an adult, I've sort of become a little bit more skeptical, or because I think that in some ways it can act detrimentally for my mob, my people, where they don't go and get themselves seen by a doctor because they think magic is the cause of it, therefore magic is going to fix it, or that it causes conflict in family and someone has to be blamed for somebody's death, which then creates payback. So there's those sorts of issues that I think, you know, we need to rethink how we view sorcery and those sorts of things. And in some ways, women also, it's used to, I guess, strike fear into the hearts of some women to control them by men. And my argument has been to some women in my family is that you know, don't allow this fear to control you. Your power, your magic is far stronger than that of someone who's trying to do you wrong.
Right. And indeed, this has been one of the things you have addressed, that there are some dysfunctions around traditional practices. One of those practices that you have been critical of is the practice of girls being promised to men by their relatives, in a sense, disempowering young people in terms of, you know, how they want to live their life. How prevalent is that practice of being promised to men?
It's very prevalent. I mean, just 2 days ago, I was having a conversation with a gentleman who holds music workshops for young Indigenous girls in our community. And one of the problems that currently the girls face is the fact that when they get to a certain age and they get into a relationship with a young man, these young men turn around and say, she's no longer going to be involved in this. She now belongs to me and it's not our culture. They're saying, they're using this excuse, it's not our culture. That she's involved in participating in something meaningful, like, you know, getting to travel the country as an artist and a musician. And it's, the sad part is, and the worst part is, the support that these young men get from the extended family, including women. And this is something that we as Aboriginal people have to look at and say, hang on a second, this is a problem. We need to recognise this as a problem and we need to do something about it. But until we can actually recognise that it is a problem and it is an issue and it's wrong and it's denying the rights of these young girls, we're not going to be able to address that so far. But these are these detrimental cultural practices that I know that we need to reform.
Did that happen in your own family?
For me personally, I remember, you know, my aunties wanting to sort of, if I was acting up or if I wasn't doing as they asked and fetching things for them, then yeah, they would tease me or they would say, you know, I'm gonna go and promise you off to your promised husband right now. I'm gonna take you to his house and you're gonna be married to him. And so I'd be terrified and I would do as I was told. So it was a form of control. I mean, I remember my aunties huddling around me. They're playing a game of cards and then a gentleman approached who was one of those men who I knew was a potential promised husband. And they all gathered around me and said, oh, he's going to take you away, he's going to take you away. And he came over and was just sort of acting out and pretending to grab for me. And I was terrified. And then they all sort of rolled about laughing, thinking it was hilarious because they were just playing a joke on me. And he sort of handed me $20 to reassure me, you know, it's okay, you know, I'm not coming for you. It's all good. And you know, it's, you know, for a young girl, those things can be absolutely terrifying. And it's all about ensuring that you're submissive.
Yeah. Well, what about the terror of discovering that you've trespassed secret men's business land? I mean, ceremonial land. Mm. Has that ever happened to you?
No, it hasn't happened to me. I know women who have been out in areas and then they've realized that they're faced with the fact that, oh, goodness, there's men around and they get really, really scared and don't want to be seen because everyone, you're brought up to believe that if you're caught under those circumstances, you can be raped, you can be beaten, and you could even be killed. And they're the punishments for happening across men's, you know, sacred business. If you speak of any of the issues that go on, you know, this is what happened. This is what's expected. But there are women who support this as well. Like, there are those who would silence me to, you know, you can't speak about those sorts of things. That's sacred men's business. So, well, if my life is in direct danger as a result of these practices, I'm going to speak about it because that's denial of my human rights.
Jacinta, have Aboriginal women ever spoken up and protested against the kind of severe punishments they've received or threats of punishment because they have inadvertently trespassed?
There are some women who have or who will protest against these sorts of things, but they're very rare to come across. And often these are women who have absolutely had a gutful, have had enough, have lived their lives as victims of domestic violence and family violence, and who have got to a point where they're retaliating. I know of one such individual in my family, and often they're the sort of scapegoats for these men, and it's said, she's crazy. It's always, she's crazy. She's crazy because she's standing up and being quite verbal and confronting about these sorts of issues, but not enough. There's too much fear, and not enough women out there are prepared to come forward and speak up about these particular issues because, you know, for fear of retaliation, for fear of violent punishment.
And when you speak up about it, how do they react to you?
Well, no one's ever direct to me about it. There's sort of an underhandedness. There's men that have passed on messages to my mother through other people. Tell Jacinta she's got to stop talking about these sorts of things, you know. And as a result of this sort of me coming out with these sorts of issues, it cost my mother her seat in her election in 2016. She had death threats brought against her from men that, you know, don't vote for Bess because she's trying to lock up all our men. These are the sorts of lies that were out there. And she's wanting to end culture. She wants to lock up all your young boys, which was just absolute lies. But then those death threats were there. And also those messages tell Jacinta she needs to stop doing this. They won't come and speak to me personally, face to face, because, well, they're insecure and I'm threatening as a woman, I guess. Yeah, there needs to be more speaking out.
I get the impression that Aboriginal society is quite patriarchal, even though one often hears about elders being women, of course, wise women. I've spoken to quite a few of them. But if you were to characterize it, how would you kind of describe Aboriginal culture or tradition on that spectrum?
It is absolutely patriarchal. The men are the final decision makers. You know, women are taught to be submissive. Men are taught to be the leaders, the owners of women that have the right to act and behave in whatever ways they like to. We women aren't supposed to upset our men because that would bring on punishment. We would be the ones to cause our own violent punishment as a result. And it's just, yeah. People can try to say that, it's matriarchal, but you know, I don't think there's many societies, small scale societies on earth, if any, that are actually matriarchal societies. So, an Indigenous, you know, society certainly isn't.
When I spoke to your mum and dad back in 2012, there'd been quite a few deaths in the family, and I've often heard people attribute the high mortality rate in Aboriginal society to the effects of colonialism. What do you think? Are the two inevitably linked?
I think colonialism plays a part in it, but I think ultimately there's the fact that our, you know, Indigenous society and law has always accepted interpersonal violence. And, you know, all small scale societies on earth used violence as a means of social control. And Western society has had many, many, many years to be able to change that and change the system to a less violent system. Whereas we have had the Western world land on our doorstep, and only in a short period of time we still have to catch up and recognize the role that traditional culture plays in perpetuating the issue of interpersonal, family, and domestic violence.
Do you hold customary law to be responsible to some extent?
Most definitely. I mean, as I mentioned, you know, when it comes to sorcery, the idea that, you know, premature death and illness is caused because, you know, somebody's killed and murdered that person, and therefore there has to be some form of punishment. When it comes to if a man dies, often the default is that the wife is blamed for his death. She's the cause of it, whether it be she didn't perform her duties correctly as a wife and look after him or whatever it be. Usually the wife is the one to receive a beating because of the death as punishment for the death of her husband. And even mothers, if they lose their children as well, the same punishment is carried out in traditional terms. So it plays a huge role, traditional law, and I don't think we've recognised that. And I don't think a lot of Australians really understand the ins and outs of traditional customary law and the impacts that it really has.
Why do you think Australians sort of keep away from that issue? I mean, they certainly involve themselves in social justice issues when it comes to sort of patriarchal violence visited on women and girls in Pakistan. We have Malala Yousafzai, who is visiting these shores at the moment, trying to raise consciousness about that. But here in Australia, the same sorts of people seem to remain rather silent on these issues that you have outlined, not only with me here, but also in your article in Mianjin.
Yes, because a lot of people don't want to be seen as being racist, and it's the easier option to turn around and say, well, you know, that is, who are we to tell other people in their own culture how to, you know, live their lives within the framework of their own culture? People often want to find the easy way of appearing to be, you know, doing the right thing, being non-racist, and ultimately being, you know, the best virtue signaler, if you like. And it's in our own backyard, and sometimes it's just too hardball to recognise what is in fact going on in our own backyard. And I think we've got to a point in our country where the guilt that remains because of our colonial past is stopping people from wanting to turn around and say, hang on a second, what about your own culture? You know, what is that doing to your own people? Because there can be such a backlash from simply saying those sorts of things. And we've seen that backlash occur over and over again. And it's really not until, you know, me being part of those two cultures that have come along and said, hang on a second, these issues need to be put on our nation's agenda and we need to start talking about it.
Jacinta Nambajimpa Price is my guest on The Spirit of Things. She's an elected member of the Alice Springs Town Council and a singer-songwriter. Here's her song, Another Way, from her album, Dry River. What are the sort of things you think need to change in Aboriginal culture itself?
Well, I think starting with a Western framework and looking at the way in which the West recognises human rights and the rights of women and children, and those same rights need to be applied to all Australians, including particularly so Indigenous Australians who are amongst the most marginalised. That's definitely what everybody needs to get behind. And for us as Indigenous people, need to start having those conversations. I know that there are many groups out there who have looked at the way that they do things. I know there's groups that have said, we aren't going to do the initiation process and for young men anymore. We don't need to do that. It's not serving us anymore. And we need to look at what is serving us well within our culture and what isn't serving us well. And we need to understand and acknowledge what is a problem to us before we can move to the next part. But, you know, it shouldn't get to the point where, like Malala Yousafzai, she's amazing. Her conversation has come about because of the fact that she was shot in the face. Like, I mean, we have many, many women who have died at the hands of our men, and we're still waiting for that moment to jolt us into action. And I don't know how many more jolts we need to actually start really having those real conversations.
Well, I certainly hope you don't experience anything like the violence that Malala has, but you've certainly endured some terrible social media attacks, words I could not even say on air.
Yes, it's been, I mean, for me personally, I sort of feel like in some ways bringing, you know, at first it was a bit, I couldn't believe how much of a, you know, tsunami of, you know, attacks that were coming at me at the time. And at first it affected me slightly. And I think I'm more concerned for my children and my family, because being on the receiving end, I think, isn't as bad as being someone who loves you, a bystander, and seeing that someone you love is being attacked so viciously. And what I found is that nobody ever says those sorts of things to my face, and social media has given a platform for all kinds of lunatics to come out and say such things. But for me, it's also just confirmed the point that I'm trying to make. We've got a problem. Here you go. Here they all are. You know, all these people attacking me, they are part of the problem. And you can see how significant the problem is. And it's time for everyone who is half decent to come out and condemn this and to acknowledge it and start supporting those of us who are prepared to speak out.
And one of the things you spoke up about was not changing the date of Australia Day, which elicited this tsunami. But there's a tendency, I think, in Australia and perhaps everywhere to go for the big gestures, you know, to kind of assuage guilt and convey regret. But what's the trade-off of relying on big gestures?
For me, I don't see a trade-off. Again, I see that it's the easy option. It is the easy option when you feel that level of guilt or you want to be seen as a non-racist to stand up and look as though you're actually putting your support behind something that, in principle, isn't going to make any practical changes or outcomes or save a single life. But it makes you feel better. It makes you feel good about being able to stand up and say, yeah, I support this, because apparently all Indigenous people want this. Well, first of all, the first mistake that's made is that somehow all Indigenous people think the same and want the same thing, when we are all individuals, all human, you know, and all Australian citizens with our own different thought processes. And I think, again, it's about doing the hard yards and having the really uncomfortable conversations. And instead of taking the easy option, we need to have those difficult conversations with one another. Particularly when it comes to saving the lives of women and children. I think it's not good enough to change the date of the day we celebrate a whole nation to think that somehow that is going to make an ounce of change on the ground when it comes to the lives of the most marginalised Australians.
Well, Jacinta, you've had a few opportunities to make this argument, and initially there was a lot of negative response. Do you think now you're gaining more ground? Are you gaining more support?
Yeah, most definitely. I'm gaining support in incredible numbers, and I think, The silent majority of Australians out there want for what is best for all Australians and are compassionate and can empathise with the most marginalised Australians. Often people feel very disempowered or they don't know how to support, but they've certainly come out in droves to provide, you know, support for me in so many ways. And the issue of Australia Day, it's funny because that is a time of the year when, you know, I come out and put forward my views and this incredible sort of backlash takes place. But for those that are against me, there's almost double those who are prepared to come behind and support me and who understand where I'm coming from. And as I said, just want for what is best for all Australians, no matter what our background is, and whether we were the first Australians or whether we're someone who's come in more recent times. And it's really wonderful, and it's what drives me to continue to do what I'm doing. And it's about changing the debate. It's about getting people to think and having those uncomfortable conversations. So I see a shift happening, and I'm happy, I'm grateful for it.
Well, Jacinta, you're a successful singer-songwriter. You mentioned that you've been in hip-hop bands quite early on. When did you start singing, and have you been able to use your music as a way of communicating some of these thoughts that we've been discussing here in a more sober fashion?
Well, I mean, I've been singing ever since I was in primary school, in the primary school choir, and then I picked up the violin when I was about 10 years old and learnt and played that for about 3 or 4 years before I headed into the hip-hop scene and then picked up guitar and started performing sort of folk and blues. And I had the wonderful opportunity of recording an album with Bill Chambers and my other half, Colin Lilly. They both helped me produce my album. And it was sort of a lot of my early sort of acoustic numbers that I'd, when I picked up the guitar when I was 19, I just automatically just started writing. And one of, you know, one of the songs, it was very much based around my life growing up here in Central Australia, sort of an ode to Central Australia and growing up in the desert, and but also those elements of, you know, understanding where my grandparents had come from, not seeing white fellas until they were in their early adolescence and their whole world turning upside down, and them understanding they had to stick to this roller coaster ride and to adapt and change, and they were never ever bitter or, you know, they never blamed people. I never heard them ever complain. They just knew you got on with life and often did it with great humour and love and happiness despite the adversity they faced. And, yeah, one of those songs, Another Way, is sort of is inspired by them and for them and also for them seeing how they themselves have had to endure losing adult children to alcohol and the challenges that came along with this new world, but always remaining hopeful. And then my grandmother, you know, some of the lyrics is my grandmother, she sits in the sun. I remember she'd sit outside in our garden and she would just talk, like by herself she'd be talking to the spirits of our family. You know, I knew for her they were always with her. And so when we lost her, she already knew she was going to be with them again and be reunited. And so that sort of song came about because of that, and with that element of the challenges that they've had to face. I mean, I guess in terms of my songwriting, I was not so political. You know, politics wasn't a big thing for me as an artist, but it certainly touched on difficult issues like that as well.
Well, that's the great beauty of music. It can go straight to the heart. And certainly your song, Another Way, which we'll hear in a moment, makes me very hopeful. Indeed, your whole approach to Aboriginal culture in the third millennium makes me very hopeful. Jacinta, how will you be celebrating? I know you have 4 boys. Is that right?
Yes, I do.
How will you be celebrating the Christmas season?
With my family, right here in Alice Springs, because I do a lot of travel, you know, campaigning, traveling a lot and interstate as well, and so does Colin. He's come back from touring with the animals and he's off again to do Christmas carols in Melbourne. And so it's really lovely to have downtime here at home and to have, you know, be surrounded by our kids and mum and dad. And we've got family friends who have become family coming down from Darwin to spend that time with us. So family is always really important. That's what keeps me grounded.
Well, Jacinta, I wish you and your family a very wonderful Christmas and New Year. Thank you so much for being on The Spirit of Things with me.
Thank you, Rachel.
Jacinta Nambajimpa Price is a Walpiri Celtic woman of the world and of Central Australia. She's a cross-cultural educator, and you can read her essay in the December issue of Meanjin, available from good newsagents and independent bookstores. Thanks this week to producer Mariam Chahab. I'm sure you've heard by now that The Spirit of Things is coming to a close. Next week will be the final edition, and for my last program, I'm the guest, as former religion journalist for The Age, Barney Swartz, interviews me. I'm Rachel Kahn. I'd love your company one last time on The Spirit of Things, right here on RN.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.